From the bayous in Louisiana to the timber country up north, you'll find them out on the trap line chasing furs to put up on the board. Mixing up another batch of that magical stuff, chilling around the fire after the show. Hey, it's Sarah and Jeff, and maybe a guest on the Trappin' Radio.
Hello and welcome to Trapping Radio 2.0. This is Jeff Dunlap. I'm at the New York State Trappers Association Convention, and I got Ronnie Smith. Ronnie owns Smitty's Boards, and you know, he sells tons of boards. So at the end or whatever, I'll have him tell you how to get a hold of him if you want some really top quality boards for stretch. This summer I've got 12 cat boards off of them, so I can do a little nicer job on my put up. So, well, thanks for doing this, Ronnie. I know we talked about it different times, but I finally got him pinned down.
You're welcome.
I've known you for quite a while, but I never, heard how you, actually got into trapping. And, everybody's got their own story, and that's what we like to do is, hear other trappers' stories, because everybody's got something unique in their story about, how they got into it. So,
I was probably 11 years old. Well, I know I was, because I didn't have a hunting or trapping license in Pennsylvania. The next door neighbor was a Second World War veteran that got out of, when he got discharged from the Marines, he had trapped the whole time he was a kid. And he got out of, when he got done the Second World War, he was the neighbor guy. I would go over there and he'd take me fishing. And he'd do this and he'd do that. And one fall he was over there and he had this big old pot of black shit there. He was a boiling and he put these traps in it. So I started asking 50 questions. I was just one of them kids, 50 questions. Gotta know, gotta know, gotta know. And he was boiling his traps. And then I wanted to know if I could go with him. Well, the first few times there it was always a no, and if he did take me, it was always, you stand here and I'll go over there. And he was making his sets and stuff, and after he had some sets out, he'd take me along. So I seen him when he was catching foxes and coons and stuff. We didn't have coyotes back then up in northern PA. And the next year I was 12. Well, I was right over to Clarence's, because I got a hunt license now, I can go trapping with Clarence. Mm-hmm. So he gave me a number 1.5 round jaw Victor trap. That's he gave me one of them, and I think I'm 99% sure I still have that. Well, I set that trap, never boiled it, never nothing. Set that trap, I caught a skunk. Well, I didn't get to go to school that particular day. I wasn't allowed at Clarence's house because I startled the skunk, and I got pretty well sprayed and covered with one of my dad's wool-rich hunting coats on. Well, that all got calmed down and stuff, and then my dad took me down to a sporting goods store and bought me a dozen 1.5 Victor jumps. And then Clarence went with me. He was the Sunday school teacher, so after church Sunday, he would go with me, help me set them, show me where, this, that, and so on and so forth. And I remember that was the Sunday that he went with me. He had a pistol. I wasn't old enough to carry a gun by myself, but he had his pistol with him. And I had a great big possum on a Sunday. I'm carrying that down the road, and its old tail is starting to curl around my hand a little bit. I said, Clarence, I said, is that possum supposed to be grabbing a hold of my hand? I showed it down the road, and he popped it again in the head with a pistol. But that's how I got started. And I had quite a few possums and some muskrats and some coons. And my father hauled me back and forth to this fur buyer and that fur buyer, and that's how I got started.
So
lots of toys over there for you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah. So you was he mostly a water trapper you were learning, or was he a land trapper? Because it seems like in them days it was like they were either one or the other. Not always, but a lot of times they were.
Yep. he lived next to a creek, so he always had a few mink and muskrat sets out, but mostly he was canine.
Yeah.
After the war, the Second World War, there was a bounty on red foxes and and the red-tailed hawks. So that's what he did for the extra income, is he was trapping for bounty. So he was a big fox trapper mostly. And then he did come up with a pretty, even today standard, a pretty good lure that he cut up the glands and he did this and he did that. And so he had his own paste lure. But he'd catch a few rats and a mink or two whenever he was driving up down the road. If there was a bridge there or he knew there was rats there, he'd stop. But he was mostly all right on the ground, right on the dirt.
Yeah. Did you trap with him for quite a while, or just he kind of showed you the ropes, and then you're on your own. Don't let me catch you in my spots.
Yeah. Well, my grandmother lived a mile upstream, but there was a road up there too, of course. But my grandmother lived a mile up the road, so I trapped on my grandmother's farm. And then, like I said, that one Sunday after church, Clarence went up there with me. He drove his car, because all I had was either foot power or bicycle. And Clarence drove his car, and we went up there, and that's when I caught that possum. But I was at Clarence's house night after night after night. And one way for him to keep me from bugging him, I realized this now over the years, he used to get Hunter, Trader, Trapper magazine and Fur, Fish, and Game. And he'd just load me up with them. Now, you take them home. When you get them all read, you bring them back. You know, like, there, I got rid of him for a week.
Yeah, and don't come back until they're all red.
Yeah, he'd load me right up, send me across the street. Yeah, but most of it is self-taught. Haubacker's book, I read that. That was a Bible to me. I read that. And some of the older books that people now are buying the paper, you know. But there was no video, there was no F&T trapping, there was none of that stuff when I was a kid. It was 99% red. My ma got mad at me because she had that Gulf canning wax in the little bricks. Put that in with my shoe max so that I was waxing my traps and I was pulling them out of the dye. So my ma's going to can some jelly and there's no wax.
So when was that, like in the 60s? Or 70s?
71, 72, 73.
Right when fur prices were really starting to go up.
They were starting to go up. And I was 18. I was a senior in school. I didn't have it.
So it's really surprising he took you out and showed you anything at that point, because, I mean, that was really, stuff had not been worth anything at all, and now it's starting to be worth like mega money in 1970 money.
Yeah.
You know, so it was, really cool that he took you out and showed you that.
Well, I didn't.
Especially in his area. You're going to train trappers. You go somewhere else and you teach them to trap. You don't take them to your own area.
Right.
Because they don't know any place else, and they're going to be right. When you go there on opening day of muskrat season, they're going back to where they know, and it's going to be right in your spot.
Yeah, but he never let me actually physically watch him make a dirt hole.
Oh, really?
I had to stay over here, and he always had his back to me. Mm-hmm. But that Haubacker book had all of them types of sets anyhow in it, so I just studied the hell out of them. Yeah. And I'd go out, and I had my ma's little garden spade and an old claw hammer and stuff like that, and a wooden stake or a piece of rebar, whatever I could find to make a stake.
That's still a good book. I mean, if there's anybody out there just getting into trapping or just started trapping, that's still a relevant book today.
Yeah.
You know, what is that? Stanley Haubacher's Trapping North American Fur Bearers?
Yep. That, to me, that was the Bible.
I think you can get that at most of the dealers.
Yep, a lot of dealers have it, and I've seen it out here on the tailgaters.
Yeah, so if you go into a convention, you might be able to get it cheaper. So you did get in on, like, some of the, because you still had Fox then in the early 70s.
Oh, yeah, we had a lot of Fox.
Yeah, so you got in on some of the high-dollar stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was senior. I was 18 and 79, a senior, and I didn't have my driver's license because I got in trouble when I was 15. So my dad hauled me around.
That is so surprising to me.
I got trouble?
Yeah, I can't hardly believe that. I mean, you guys can't see him, but his angel wings are just, and his halo are so bright.
So my dad would truck me all over. And I didn't know, Clarence had showed me how to do the skinning and so on and so forth. And I had everything skinned, rolled up. We put it in feed bags and put them in my mom's freezer, chest freezer. But that was with the stipulation that Saturdays, my dad took me to a fur buyer. So when we would go every Saturday, whether I had one coon or three foxes or whatever I had, he took me to the fur buyer. And there were times in my senior year that I had more cash money in my pocket than most of the teachers did in 1979.
Huh.
The other kids were farm kids and so on and so forth. They always had a couple dollars in their pocket and stuff. But mm-hmm. I mean, I had more money in my pocket than some of the teachers.
Mm.
And I remember that like it was just yesterday.
Yeah, it was a pretty cool time. I'm glad I lived through that and got to experience the tail end of it.
In 82, I got married. In 82, I worked construction, got laid off Halloween, so that gave me the opportunity to start trapping. I was a week late for our opening, but that was the most money I ever had in my whole life. Drawing unemployment, trapping those $65 red foxes and $35 coons and stuff. That was the most money I ever had every week.
Yep. Yeah, people paid for their college educations. They paid for their houses. They bought, brand new pickup trucks.
Yep. Clarence had a new truck every 2 years for money.
And we're all happy that, I mean, it's like we were talking yesterday, about I was so happy to, be able to sell a greased beaver for $25. How many greased beaver do you have to catch to pay for a 2024 diesel? I don't know how many that is. I'm sure somebody will let me know now, but, it's
a hell of a lot more than I have knives to skin.
Yeah. But, I know everybody says they don't do it for the money, but and that's true. But, it's nice to have the element of money, pay for the gas. And, I know I always see a lot happier trappers when the price is coming up than when it's, flattened out.
Yep. Yep. And the sales like you and I are in here, setting up a booth to sell our products and stuff. In the last 10 years, there's been a serious drop. I mean, we're still here. We're still bringing the stuff to the customer and stuff, but it's not like it was 10 years ago, here, as far as people wanting this board or that board or half a dozen of these, or even if they're making their own, using my boards for a pattern, or, it just isn't there like it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. It definitely has changed in the last 10 years. The further we get away from 2013, which was the last big money hurrah, it definitely goes down and down. And I also think part of that is, not going down this rabbit hole too far, but, a lot of the associations can't get away from 1970. They don't do social media. They don't, they think they work with the kids, but they don't work with the kids. So the fur prices and the associations being in 1970 definitely don't help.
No.
And I know I'm no expert, but I've always been willing to help, try and grow this any association. Like Minnesota's reached out to us and we've really tried to do something with them, and they've it's been a great partnership,
There's no kids. There was two or three other kids in my class my senior year. They got for a fishing game, and the one kid, he was a hell of a mink trapper. I mean, a senior in high school, and he's out there catching 20, 30 mink. But today, even over home, those cricks have changed so much in the past 40, 50 years that I remember when I was a kid, that if we catch three mink in 7 mile stretch of crick, we had that's pretty good.
Yeah.
But back then, I had that one buddy there. He was catching the mink. He just was after the mink.
It seemed like perception isn't reality, but the perception it is to me that when them animals were being hammered on by trappers when that prices were up, all that stuff was a lot healthier. There was, you know, I mean, fox prices were high. They were killing the shit out of them. You know, and there was tons of red fox. Same way with raccoons, muskrats. And as soon as that price went down, the population started going down, you know, because people weren't trapping them and the disease and all that.
Mother Nature will maintain the habitat or the whatever for the feed for the animals that are there. And parvo and rabies and distemper and everything else is a hell of a lot worse.
I had heard that she's a cruel bitch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep. A mangy fox. Yeah. Down below zero. There's nothing any worse than to see a mangy fox down below zero.
No. No. Just all the hair he's got is on the tip of his tail.
Yep. And I mean, maybe. He's just standing there shivering, and I'm surprised he just didn't die.
Yep.
I mean, it's just cruel.
Yep. Probably wishing he was going to die.
Well, he did.
He did. So you started out, you know, trapping, and then, you know, with the guy, and then, you know, you moved on, and your dad was taking you to the fur buyer and all that. You know, did you keep trapping right on through, or, you know?
Yep, I trapped in 1982 when I was married, and I got laid off that winter. I needed a job, so I went in the service for 3 years, and as soon as I got back out, I was right back into trapping. And it was mid to late 80s when I come to my first trapping convention, but I would come to these and spend money. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd come here and spend money.
You were the guy you're looking for.
Yeah. 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 One time we were going home. I had my son with me then, and we were going home. My old mind was just burning. You know, I spent over $250, and some of this stuff I can do. And that's how I started making the boards. I mean, yeah. I had a full cabinet shop being a contractor and stuff, mm-hmm. So I started making boards. I'm done spending money. Let's make a dollar.
Yeah. Yeah. Trappers are definitely creative. You know, a lot of times you have to, you know, something doesn't fit the situation, so you got to bend it to, you know, or come up with something.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's the only 3 years since I was 12 that I hadn't bought a fur taker's license was when I was in the service.
Mm.
And that would be 52 years.
Well,
that I've been buying fur
takers. Since you're in the service, I think we got to give you them 3 years. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, when, like, did you pretty much go into land trapping, or were you trapping the water? Because, you know, I mean, were you trapping the creeks? And, you know, when you start seeing the decline in the mink, you know, did you notice that it was going on? Or?
I never really was much of a water trapper. I trapped a few muskrats when I was younger, when I was even in.
So you're a glory land trapper.
Yeah. I was walking from the creek from my grandmother's. Like I said, she was just a mile upstream from down home, and the school bus let me off right at her property. Back then, you know, you didn't have to have 50 permission slips and this and that and everything else. Bus driver, hey, Ike, I'm going to grandma's. Mm-hmm. Drop me off at grandma's.
Yeah.
And had my hip boots on at my grandmother's, so I changed my shoes and I walked the creek home. Had a few muskrats, that's all. Well, after about the third time of me going in the creek with the snow on and the ice and everything else, I decided water trapping really wasn't my cup of tea. That damn cold, that mile walk wet, boots are full of water and everything else. So I stayed pretty much on the ground.
Yeah.
And I couldn't wait to get to the next convention when Ron and Pete Leggett were there.
Mm-hmm.
Because old Pete, he'd tell you, I mean, then if you watch his videos, but he'd tell you how to find your locations and mm-hmm. different things and so on and so forth. And I took a lot of that to heart and took it back home, you know, and then mm-hmm. I'm driving down the same damn farm road that I knew since I was a kid, even in a stroller, and I start looking around and I think, shit, right there. Why mm-hmm. haven't I set a trap right there? You know, I'm driving by, but right there is what Pete Leggett's talking about. Yeah. I run out there and make a set. 2 days later, I got a red fox out there bouncing. Just because I know what I'm supposed to be looking for in the location.
Yeah, the old man knew what he was talking
about. You're damned right he did. That old boy was just neat. Yeah. But stuff like that, you just kind of you kind of pay attention to it. You hear it, but then when you can see it with your own eyes, what he just said, that puts those locations so much easier now to find.
Yeah. Definitely when you see it yourself and you put that, start putting the pieces together. And that's why I like trapping so much, is you never complete the puzzle.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you completed the puzzle and you were just awesome, I mean, what fun would that be? Right. You know, it's more fun just learning every year. I change stuff I do every year. You know, I mean, if I went back and watched videos, the first video I ever did, I would be like, oh man, he don't know shit. You know? And I didn't know shit. You know, I mean, you'd hope that you'd change your thought patterns and, you know, over 20 years.
Yep.
You know, so.
And some of that stuff is just, I mean, it's right there in front of you. But until that light switch clicks on where you've done this or that, just something to change it that little bit before you think, well, now you dumb son of a bitch, you've been doing it that way, and now all of a sudden you just change that just that little bit, and now look what's happening.
Yep.
And it's all right there in front of us.
Yep. Yeah, sometimes you just, trapper just needs to, you know, have a one piece click into place, and they take the next step. But when you were going to the conventions and stuff, I mean, you mentioned Pete and Ron Leggett, and I didn't know Pete, but I know Ron. Mm-hmm. Ron's a heck of a nice guy.
Yeah.
What other people like that demos did you like to go see? And
I went and heard Russ Carman didn't do any sets, but he was doing a question and answering thing one time. And then one year up here, Russ was in Bill Caston's.
Oh yeah.
And I went.
Him and Bill were good buddies. They were neighbors.
Yeah. They were right there from the same township or whatever.
I could be wrong, but I thought Russ told me that they lived they were actual neighbors. But he might have been, like 5 mile neighbors.
Right.
You know. I guess I didn't. I just assumed next door, but I didn't know that for sure. Now I'm thinking about it.
But I spent 45 minutes there at Bill Caston's booth, sitting side by side with Russ Carman, and that to me. I mean, I seen you and so on and so forth. That's always a good time. But that to me, that 45 minutes with Russ Carman, that was worth the whole trip.
Yep.
That was the trip of a lifetime, just to hear him visit.
Yep. Yeah,
I mean, if
he's I would say that he's in the trapping world. The people that I've met and stuff, I met a lot of good friends, but he's probably the most humble, nicest man I've ever met in the trapping world. I mean, he's just—I don't know how to describe it other than he just seems like a good man.
Yeah, he just sat right there. Didn't I mean?
There's no arrogance about him. Mm-mm. I mean, when I did the first interview with him, we talked for, I don't know, two hours maybe, and I say sitting in the truck, just me and Russ, and just and I said, we better turn the tape recorder on and get this thing started, because I mean,
and he was still good for another 2 hours.
Where I made my mistake on the interview is I hadn't done very many, and so I cut it off. I wish I'd just let him just.
Oh yeah.
If he had sat there for 5 hours, I always regretted that. You know, it's a time you're like, I don't want to take up any more of his time. But he was good with it. He seemed comfortable in the seat. I had some water there for him. So
He was just that. Like I said, that was just the whole highlight of that. And that was the year that we were supposed to wear a mask when they had the COVID.
Yeah.
And he was there with Bill Caston's, and I said, Bill, do you mind if I go over and talk to Russ? Well, ask Russ if you can visit with him. So I went over.
I was surprised Bill didn't say, just give me the $5 admission fee. I miss Bill.
Him and Ed.
I used to see them all the time at Cat County show, and then I'd see him here. Bill would be set up on the outside of there. And there's a lot of them guys. Like, at this. That's why I like this show. A lot of the guys that I looked up to, like Russ would be here, and I remember, where Russ was set up down here, and then Johnny Thorpe would be around, if you went right up the road and went to the left, Johnny Thorpe would be sitting there in his old style lawn chair with straps missing out of it. He'd be sitting there in his cowboy hat with his, you know, his jeans on with his, you know, cowboy boots crossed.
And all of his turquoise and silver and turquoise.
Yeah. You weren't. You didn't know if he was half buzzed up or if he wasn't. It looked like it, but I wasn't sure.
If he wasn't,
I couldn't even tell if he was. I mean, half time I walked by there, I couldn't tell because he never moved. If he was like sleeping or dead.
Yeah. You know, it's so. Like going to Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah. And there'd be Art Clark sitting right next to him.
Yeah. Is Art gone?
Somebody today said he was trapping out west, but I don't know.
Okay.
I haven't seen him. I haven't seen him in like 2 years.
No, I haven't heard that name or seen
him. Every time I seen Artie, he would come by my booth and say, "Do you know how to make crayfish oil the way Johnny Thorpe did?" I'm like, "Yeah, I do." Who told you? I says, "Johnny Thorpe." And I don't know if his memory was going or what, because when Johnny told me about it, Art was right there, sitting in the right in the same chair next to him.
Probably both been sipping out of the same bottle.
Yeah, they're probably like, I don't ever remember seeing you before. But no, that's a great thing about, you know, coming to, you know, these conventions and stuff is the, you know, getting to see guys like Russ Carman and, you know, I mean, what is there better trappers than Russ Carman? Absolutely. I'm sure there are lots of, you know, but the thing is he wrote the books. He took his time and decided to write the books, and, you know, Russ became famous in the trapping world, and it didn't make him the best trapper. It just made him the best known trapper,
right.
You know, and that, you know, can get it where, you know, he can help he helped the trapping industry, you know. The people looked up to him, wanted to be like Russ, and, you know, I mean, shit, you know, I mean, he's humble a guy as he is. That's a good target to shoot for, is being like Russ Carman.
Yeah. Yeah. He's just as much down to earth as our uncles or anybody else, yeah. As far as visiting with him. Yeah. He's just there. Yep. And people like that, everybody's after their numbers. And, Sarah picks on me because I still have a flip phone. I get a Garmin GPS. I got a digital camera I have to plug into the computer in order to see a picture. She said, you know, if you just get a smartphone, you got all that right in it. You know, you got video and you can take pictures. But I bet I don't have six pictures when that would have been if somebody went with me to see a coyote in that set, or my little dog out with the coyote at that set, or me holding the red fox, I don't think I've ever had a tailgate picture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't give a shit if I catch 2 coon or 100 coon per year. It just depends on what the market's going to do. I'm not on social media showing off all my tailgate pictures and stuff. I don't care.
Yeah.
But trapping season to me, and I told Dorinda, I said, you know, if you ever want to make any special days, you're going to have to do it before October 26th, because from there until the 1st of April, you'll see me every night, but I'm in the fur shed, I'm making boards, and I'm checking my own traps.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of a way of life.
A trapper's widow.
Just for 6 months a year.
Yeah. As long as they don't grow to like it too much.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah.
Might have to stop in a couple times.
Yeah. I'm going to stop in before the neighbor does.
Yeah. Sport coat.
Yeah. Yep. But Russ and those guys, they didn't really, I mean, he never told me numbers or never, but back when he was trapping versus what we are today, we have the snowmobiles and we have the four-wheelers and the side-by-sides, and we can cover hundreds of miles versus those guys doing 20 miles.
Yeah.
And that, the more miles you put on means the more sets you've got, which naturally would be more numbers you're going to make.
Yeah.
And those guys didn't really have all that capabilities, really.
I never ever got a season catch pitcher, because most of the time I was having to sell the stuff as the season was going on, just to, you know, keep going.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I never, like this year, I couldn't. If up for $1 million, other than the bobcats we caught, I couldn't tell you one animal the numbers that we, if I had to like have the numbers exactly, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
We didn't care. We just was killing them and selling them and we were going more by, you know, we only got one freezer left to fill.
Yeah, it's, I don't know.
Somebody busts a Ronnie ball.
Oh, yeah.
Always.
People have asked me what my best catch was per season, you know, like on a specific animal. And I'm up in Potter County, and we have coyotes, and every farmer will tell you where they're at and when they heard them and seen them in a field, or they got after a calf or this or that or something. But I don't know. I don't know if I had a good year, bad year, because I don't really know how to compare it to Potter County when the trappers aren't there like they were 10 years ago.
Yep.
I mean, I don't... If I catch 20 of them, was that a good year for me? Yeah, that's a good year for me. The neighbor 30 miles away may have got 30. Maybe he only got 10.
But. Yep. In 2013, I couldn't tell you what I caught. But I can tell you that I made $27,000... in 2.5 months in Louisiana trapping otters and beavers and raccoons.
Yeah.
When the price was high.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I, but I couldn't tell you
the numbers.
The
part
number.
Of it.
I mm-hmm. couldn't.
That's
I
like,
was just, you know, killing them and selling them. And
That first dozen traps that my dad bought me, he bought them and I paid him back for them. And I couldn't tell you if I had 3 possums or 13 possums and 2 coons and 3 muskrats, and I have no idea what I had, but I paid him back at $32 for that dozen 1.5 Victor jumps. And I remember that I had a $100 bill left, and I was 13 years old, and I just couldn't.
You were rich.
Oh, I never heard of one, and I got one right there in my hand. Old Vic Taylor, fur buyer from Shingle House, gave me a $100 bill, and I just thought, huh? I mean, that to me, that was $1 million, time after time.
One time, I don't know the exact year. It was probably like 82, something like that. And I was just a kid, young teenager. And my dad says, was buying fur for her. I don't know if he was buying for Hudson Bay then yet or not. But I had a mink put up, and I went and said, well, how much do you give me for this mink? I see everybody else walking over their fur, and I think, I'm going to sell my fur. So I said, how much do you give me for the mink? And he says, oh, I'll just go put it away, and he kind of blew me off. So anyways, there was an old fur buyer that had bought fur there before we moved there, up like 1.5 miles away. I got my bike and rode all the way up to that fur buyer's and sold that fur to that other guy. I got back. My dad said, my dad found out about it. He said, even my own kid cuts my throat. So apparently at 12 years old, I didn't have much loyalty. I've learned the importance of loyalty more as I've gotten older.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? If you're a fur buyer, you strike when the iron's hot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I can. Clarence, this is long before Pennsylvania ever had a cable restraint, because when he was doing them bounty on red foxes, he would set cables. Back then, take a metal bread tie and hang it on the bottom strand of barbed wire and so on and so forth. And he showed me that. And I had to have one. I can take you right to the fence post, and the fence is still there today, just up the road from my grandmother's, 1/2 mile up a farm lane where I caught my first red fox with a cable.
Hmm.
And that was back, nobody even knew what a cable was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what during the bounty, it didn't matter. They just wanted the bounty for the boxes and stuff. And that fence post, that fence is still right there. I mean, 52 years later, still right there.
Hmm. Did you ever sell any stuff for the bounty, or was it off by the time?
It was off when I was there. Clarence had got a real job down at the Westfield Tannery in the carpenter shop, but he was trapping, fishing, nighttime eel fishing and stuff, freshwater eels. And
do they still do that in Pennsylvania?
Not too much, because they put those flood, like Army Corps puts, so that the flood they can't get upstream. Oh. They can't come in.
So they can't spawn, so their numbers went down?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we'd go out and we'd catch them. And,
did you ever eat them before?
Oh, yeah. That's what we caught them for.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, them things...
I'm not squeamish on the whole thing, but I don't know. The main guys are probably like, oh, they're great, you know, but... the meals are pretty nasty.
Right? Everybody says it tastes like chicken. Hell, shit, to me, they didn't taste like no damn chicken. Tastes like an old dirty turtle. they weren't. Some people liked them. I didn't care for them.
Mm.
They didn't care for them.
No, there goes Mark Stick.
Yep.
And Bob.
And Bob.
Bob's the star.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's weird that Mark didn't have his TV show, he didn't have that lady doing his makeup as he was walking across there.
Yeah.
She must be in the car.
I see Bob's got a new truck. He got rid of the van.
Bob does have a new truck?
Yeah, got rid of the van. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting to see him all the way out here.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yep. Well, he used to set up here, I guess.
Yep. Well, the one year he set up right beside you where Painter was.
Oh, he did?
Yep.
Was I there?
Mm-hmm. Because we helped him get
the real crazy shit I block out.
We helped him wheel that one thing up on that ramp one time.
Yeah.
He had it about four times over full and four of us out there trying to get it up that.
It almost seems like that's when he was going back after that, that's when he had his heart attack.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, because he was alongside the road and had the heart attack.
Yep.
Bob did CPR on him and brought him back.
Yeah. Look in his face.
Don't leave me, you son of a bitch.
Yeah. Yeah, old Bob Mark, it's going to be a tough day when they separate.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't know who's going to go first.
Yeah.
Bob's in better shape, I think.
He had a pretty good gait to him every going across
there.
Yeah,
Mark was dragging his feet, but Bob was kicking ass.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's good to see him out here. I used to talk to Mark quite a bit, but since he sold the Dakota line and all that, I don't seem to talk. So I used to buy some stuff off him, and, you know, now that was why we were talking, apparently.
Right. I seen him down at the PA States. He set up across from us. He come over and was visiting with Dorinda about our dog and stuff. And when he had Dakota line, I bought a bunch of cables and different things, and I still use and buy his Weeby knives and stuff. He's got some good stuff out there.
Yeah, I use a lot of his Weeby knives. When I first started using them, I'm like, I hate these things, because there wasn't one thing I skinned that I didn't cut. But my thing is, I was acting with the Weeby knife that's like a scalpel, like I'm using a dull Chicago coloring.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the knife, it was definitely the user.
Yep.
But, you know, it's easy for us when... you know, you do something stupid to blame it on the equipment.
Yeah.
It wasn't me drinking and driving, it was the truck.
Yep. It's like that computer. That's the dumbest thing there ever was. Nothing wrong with the computer, it's the guy putting the shit in it.
Yeah. No, computer never looked up porn by itself.
No. FBI wasn't knocking on your door either. Yeah.
Oh, there's John Rockwood. All the big celebrities are walking by at the New York State Trappers.
Yeah.
So then you were trapping, and then you decided, I think I'll try my hand at fur buying.
Yep, we all make mistakes.
Because
I started about 13 years too late.
Yeah.
That's the truth. 10 years ago, I started buying fur.
Yeah, that's about how I felt with the DVD market. Exactly the same. I was about 10 years too late.
Yeah. And I buy the local guys that come in and out of my shop. They bring their stuff in. Some of it, they want their cash. Other guys, they just drop it on the floor, tell me what it's worth. They go in my shop over in the stock room, and they'll buy lure, knives, more traps, whatever they need. But the fur market... for me as a buyer, it's all but gone.
Yeah. But you still do buy some fur?
Yep. Yep. I go to a few auctions and stuff and either sell or buy.
Yeah.
If somebody wants something. In PA, we're only allowed the one bobcat. Well, you go up in New York State, they're unlimited in a lot of the counties that are around me. Mm-hmm. And one of the neighbor guys say, boy, I'd really like to have a tan bobcat. Okay, I'll go to the auction and see if I can pick one up. Mm-hmm. We'll send it out to the tannery for you, and you'll have a tan bobcat. Mm-hmm. I said, it's not one you caught, but I don't care. He said, I just want a tan bobcat.
So I can tell everybody a story. I just need the cat.
Right. Yeah.
Right. You don't care as long as he gives you the $150.
Yeah, I don't give a shit what he tells them. Yeah.
You're not going to be invited to the tea party anyway.
No. No, nobody wants an old stinky fur buyer at a tea party. Yep.
But you still buy deer hides and...
No, I give up on the deer hides. The whole overall market is just so far down that the deer hides and stuff. I mean, the deer hides I was paying...
They came back a couple years ago, didn't they?
Yep. Now they're down to... If I give you a dollar for a deer hide, I've got to almost fight to get $2.50 or $3 out of it. And I'm buying the salt. And I'm splitting all the legs. I'm cutting off all the extra meat and trying to get it cleaned up, salting it. And you've got to do that when they bring them in and drop them on the ground. Hopefully they aren't froze.
Yep.
If not, then you start getting rot and slipping and everything else. And to me, I mean, I'm not greedy, but I'd like to get at least paid for my time and my salt. And there's just... But there was an old boy, Bob Weeks, over to Westfield when I was a kid hunting the first day of deer season. Because a lot of the neighbor ladies, the widows and stuff, the older ladies, they would take in hunters. And she'd get them, they'd get up in the morning, she had a great big breakfast for them, they all got a bag lunch, and then when they got done, she had a great big supper. There were old farm women, widows, and so on and so forth, so they knew how to cook a meal for them guys that were hunting. And old Bob Weeks had an old truck, had an old Chevy truck with wooden stakes on the side of it, and he'd knock on the door, if he seen a deer hanging in your yard, he'd knock on the door and give you a $5 bill for that deer hide.
Hmm.
And that was back in 73, 74, mm-hmm. back then. Well, hell, 10 years ago, I'm still giving guys a $5 bill for a deer hide. I'm selling it for $8 or $9, maybe even $10, depending on how many I had.
Yep.
Well, today, if nobody, with the price of gas and everything else, nobody will bring a deer hide 2 miles to me for $2 or $3, and no. I'm gonna make a dollar on it to sell it.
Yep.
So now I haven't touched any deer hides.
You got 75 cents of salt in it.
Yeah, yeah. I go to the Agway and buy all my salt.
Yep.
And beef hides, I don't care if I ever touch another beef hide.
No, when I was buying deer hides, we used to buy semi-loads of them. And they had like some farm beef hides, which were worth less money than packer hides. Mm-hmm. And... I'd buy a couple and then, you know, use them as a tarp to put over the top of, you know, the, like on the 1-ton truck, I could get about, they're West Virginia deer hides, I get about 700 plus the outs, which would run 200-300, but about 10 to 20% outs, you mm-hmm. know, when they went to the 7.5 square foot. And, but other than that, I was like, yeah, I don't want no part. I didn't have a high low, I didn't have shit. And there's no way I want any part of these cow hides. They're heavy. And I don't remember. It seems like them things used to go for like, I don't remember, $80.
Yep.
You know, I mean, and more.
They were anywhere from $65 to $85, $90 for a good one. And if you cleaned it up good and had it good and salted, and that buyer was even remotely impressed, he would give you $65. He didn't have to look at every one of them.
Yeah.
But if he seen where you had two or three of them and they were all the same and you got them cleaned up and they were all split and salted nice, he'd just buy the whole lot of them and just give you an average.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, you start muscling down two or three of them. When the farmers, we got two or three butcher shops over there. And I'd go buy them from the farmers or the butcher shop. Well, it's only me. Well, them bastards are heavy, I'll tell you what, to drag them around, open them up, yep. And they don't take just a couple coffee cups of salt like a deer hide does. I mean, here's a half a bag of salt on that thing, and you're down on your hands and knees and getting it rubbed in, getting it all taken care of, and cutting off the meat, and mm-hmm. I don't care if I ever see another one.
No. We'd buy, you know, like 28 to 30,000 deer hides a year.
Mm-hmm.
Then we started cutting the tails off and doing all that. And I had a pretty good market, you know. Started off like 50 cents. We sold, first time we did them deer tails, we just cut them off and then took them to Ray Rumpf out to Pennsylvania. And he was right, I think it, shit, I don't remember, some, like Philadelphia and somewhere out there. And we got out there and changed the price. We drove all the way from Northern Michigan, me and my brother. And so I don't remember what we ended up getting, like 30 cents a piece. And I was like, we're so better off than throwing them away. I mean, we get out of, you know, only bought, you know, probably half of the deer hides had good tails on them.
Yep.
You know, but, and we, a lot of them came with the bones already out of them. But then I finally kept dinking with it. My dad says, all I want to do is see the check. I don't want none. Well, I show him the check. Well, then he wanted to be involved, you know. So then we started selling to Wapsie down to Arkansas. And they were the best ones we ever dealt with. And
Was that the whole hide or the tail?
Just the tail.
Just the tail.
Yeah. And it was a, you dry them. You know, this is, they kind of look like a Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all natural, dried, and buck a piece.
Yep.
You know. And that was just an extra. I bought the hide for the price, and then cut the tail off, and never figured that in the buying in case it didn't work out. You know, but
yep. So, you used to put hundreds of them on pallets and cover them up with tarps, and just. But no, that it's like everything else. It's just, things are just fizzling away on us.
Yeah. Which is weird because you know. Like, you don't see people wearing fur, but you see people wearing leather products all over. You know, wearing belts, you know, the white leather, you know, like in Nike tennis shoes is deer. You know, the nurse's shoes are, you know, white is deer. You know, so, you know, most of the white leather stuff is deer. This is that weird, like, pig hide or sheep or whatever the hell it is.
We had a glove factory over in Galton, Pennsylvania. It was Smith's deer skin gloves, and if you took a deer hide over there, they would give you two pairs of their gloves.
Mm-hmm.
And they were lined with long johns, looked like a long johns. Mm-hmm. But if you took your deer hide over to them, they give you two pairs of gloves.
They should have thought of marketing, because they should, if you bring two deer hides, we'll give you two gloves. And then you get in the truck and you got two left-handed gloves. Well, the next time you come, you bring two deer hides, you get the two right. So so everybody has to, like, bring two more to get them extra.
In order to have a match pair.
Yeah, they're not very good on their marketing.
had an old boy in Harrison Valley that only had one arm, so he didn't give a shit if he took them two or four. He only needed the one glove.
Yeah, he's not a good customer, because he's not going to wear them out as twice as fast.
No.
Might be a nice guy, but a bad customer.
Yeah.
For gloves, anyways. So the so then you transitioned into, you know, doing the boards and.
Yeah, I went to. I don't remember where it was, but anyhow, Tom Tyree was doing a demo.
Was he from Virginia?
Yes. Where's the bibs?
Yeah.
Shoes and tobacco.
Yep.
He was either a fur pickup or whatever for fur harvesters,
mm-hmm.
or NAFA, or maybe both.
Yep.
But he was doing a skinning demo and so on and so forth. And he was telling putting it on the wood versus putting it on the wire and so on and so mm-hmm. forth and this and that. Oh, my light switch clicked on, because I was a building contractor, and I had the whole shop full of table saws, radial arm saws, band saws, routers and shapers and sanders and whatever else, drill presses. And I thought, you know, I got every damn tool that I need to make a board.
Mm-hmm.
So I started getting on the computer, have my daughter get me where I needed to go so I could just scroll with the mouse, you know. And I got into them websites, and God, look at that. Here's the picture of it. So many inches down, it's this wide. So many inches down, it's this wide. And then I started making patterns. And I probably made and threw it away and burnt in a wood stove twice as many patterns as I've ever made boards, because this cut or that cut or this didn't do this or this didn't do that and so on and so forth. And finally, I got the patterns down to where they're, I think I was making them too hard versus what the ease in it should have been. Now I can make a pattern in 10 minutes. If you tell me you want a board that's going to be this, this, and this, I can make you a pattern in just a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. Shit, back then, it was a day or two, and I'm a sanding, and I'm a filing, and doing this, and doing that. It just, but finally, I got to where I could make patterns, decent patterns, good patterns, cookie cutter patterns, and then the boards started coming out a lot better. And I added a few more tools to make the boards a little more uniform and easier to, you know, to produce, to make a four dozen 7.5-inch coon board. Now I can just go in the shop and in a half a day make them. Mm-hmm. You know, where before, oh, you want four dozen boards? And I mean, I'm just getting all kinds of antsy now. But that's it. It's like anything, whether you're a block layer or a sheetrock finisher or anything, after you get into it and you get a rhythm, or you figure out this works better or that works better, or this is just as quick and easier and so on and so forth. The old boys used to say, don't work harder, work smarter.
Yep.
I finally let that sink into my head a little bit, where things, and then now the boards, they come out, and I'm pretty happy with most of the overall boards, and they're either a NAFA or a Fur Harvester's pattern, and I've got the pattern. You can sit right there and measure it off with a book right beside you, and down 2 inches, it's 2.5 inches wide, and down four, it's 5 inches wide, and so on and so forth, and just connect the dots and make it shaped.
And the board's got to be right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the whole purpose of the wood board versus the wire, is the uniformity. I mean, it's more of a, and I tell people when I do a demo on the boards that you can take 1,000 Red Foxes and you're not going to find two of them. They're going to fit a board the same exact way.
Yeah.
It's a suggestion so that when they're lined up, when they're putting them in their lots for the market, everything looks uniform.
Yeah.
You know, you can put an 18-pound Red Fox on the same board as you do a 22-pound Red Fox.
Yeah.
But at least it's all the nice same width, same consistency, so on and so forth. And other than that, the fur and the grading of the fox is the only thing that's going to be, you know, downgraded or upgraded or whatever. But the boards all being the same thing.
Yeah. Especially like on, you know, raccoons and stuff, you know, I mean, you got the wire stretchers and, you know, push them in and grip them with one hand and slide them up in. You know, I mean, they don't always bounce back, or the newer ones bounce back too much, and it's hard to get it exactly. So that, you know, the wood is definitely good in that aspect.
Yeah, and you with the push pins and stuff versus the two clips on the wire, you can pin that any place where you want that leather to be, and that'll stay there.
Yeah.
With the wire stretchers, and you're using the two clips, the more that the critter is shrinking down, those clips are sliding up that wire, whether you know it or not. I mean, you measure that, take a picture of it with your yardstick right on it. 2 weeks later, you go in and you wipe the grease off from it, and you take the clips off from it, lay it right down, take a picture, and now look at them two pictures.
Yeah.
Tell me it didn't shrink, and it didn't move, it didn't do this. Well, that skirt wasn't up there like that before.
Yeah.
And with the wood, you put that on, and with the patterns, and you could put however many you want on them coons, and you pin them, and when you take them pins out, that didn't move. I mean, you've got a nice straight skirt, everything's staying. Open up the tail, you got a nice looking tail.
Mm-hmm. No, I've thought and said for quite a while that, you know, putting up the fur now, when you take it in there, it's a beauty contest. It wasn't always that way. Before, it was just production. They just wanted, you know, say 100,000 raccoons, you know. But now it's more of a beauty contest, and the better your fur looks, you know, the more you're going to get out of it.
Well, I've got guys that, and I preach it all the time when I'm doing a demo. Every time you do a coon, I don't care if you use just a newspaper, wipe the beam off.
Yeah.
Because you got a greasy coon you just
took off there. I could not stand to, like, put that raccoon on a greasy beam.
Well, now you're taking it off that greasy beam and you're putting it on this board.
And then trying to fluff the fur up.
Yeah. And those guys, they'll call me 6 o'clock at night and say, hey, if we get there by 7:30, we got some fur for you. If that's not too late, bring it up. They bring me in these coons. They got a real nice access window. They did a damn good job flushing them, including the tail. I mean, everything looks good. They wipe down the sweat and everything. I open up that access window, and that goddamn hair is just as packed down as the leather is. I can't even rub my hand in it.
Yeah.
And I look at them, and I say, you know, for 5 seconds, the fleshing and everything else, but I said, I can't grade that hair. I said, look at it. I open it right up, and I said, no, look at that.
That's why I always took, like, I would wipe the beam off, but, you know, like, just like Ronnie just described, when he's opening that up and he's seeing that hair's all flattened out, I would always take borax in that window, mm-hmm. and on the flanks, you know, is where the flanks is where they open it up by the window, and it's the, where the blades were in that whole area, and I would take borax and just borax that area and then kind of, you know, just kind of shake the coon to get it out.
Yeah.
I mean, when the, just like you said, when the buyer opens that and that pops out at them, that you would have a whole different experience with that, buying that coon, then it's, you know, grease.
Yep.
You know.
Then I'll go over and get one that I would put up or somebody else would put up that took the time to make sure, wipe off your boards, wipe off that beam. Don't be afraid of a little borax. Don't be afraid to get the leaf blower out and get things cleaned up, fluffed up and stuff. Yep. And I lay that coon down and I said, here's your coon. I said, here's a $10 coon, here's a $2 coon.
Yeah.
And you probably did a better job flushing it than what this one over here is, but you didn't do anything about the fur. You just let the fur stay matted down, just pat tight.
Which is the key to the, what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fur's the key.
And I tell them, the big debate between the MBs and the Dukes and the Victors and the, you know, Bridgers and so on and so forth. You can make a pretty good fur dollar by just picking up roadkill.
Yep.
Just by putting up your fur so it's proper, it's clean, it's brushed out, it looks good, so on and so forth.
Yep.
That's where your money is.
Yep.
That trap didn't make you a damn penny.
No
more than the neighbor's car just hit that coon. You can get more money out of that coon than you can that one you trapped.
Yeah.
I tell them people.
As long as the guts ain't blowed out the back.
Yeah, well, I'm not skinning it. I'm just looking at the finished product.
Yeah. So, where can they, like, if somebody wants to buy boards from you, do you ship boards or do you just...
I ship boards, but the last 5 or 6 years, I shipped a couple of coon boards. They were $6 a piece. It was $12 for the boards. And every board you buy, you get one belly wedge with it. You can buy 100 more belly wedges, but you get a belly wedge with every board. So they buy $12 worth of boards, and it costs $28 to ship them.
Hmm.
And if they buy a dozen boards, it might cost $52 to ship them.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to really shy away from the shipping. I've had some other guys that would, like Brian Flowers. He delivered boards to the one show where F&T was, because the one salesman in there knows the guy that wanted the boards out in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So, I mean... via 3 or 4 different sets of hands, we can get them to a convention where somebody can stop in and pick them up.
Yeah.
Or come to my shop and pick them up. Or come to one of the shows that we're at and pick them up.
You don't have a Facebook page.
No, but you can contact me on my Facebook through the regular messenger.
Mm-hmm.
It's under just Ronnie Smitty. And you'll see a picture of me there and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have a web page or a real life Facebook page per se.
Just a businessman.
I just make boards and sell them. Try to make happy customers.
So if somebody wanted to come to your shop, where are you at? You're in Pennsylvania.
I'm in Potter County, up in Harrison Valley.
Okay.
I'm right on the northern. If you go to the top of my hill and you look out across there, 3 miles away, the crow flies, I'm in New York State.
Hmm.
I'm right up on the New York PA line.
What shows are you going to be going to the rest of this year?
I got one show next weekend, which is September 6th and 7th at the Clinton County Fairgrounds in PA.
And that's your last one?
That'll be my last one for this year.
Okay.
And then next year I'll start probably with a show in the little burg called Arnett, and then I'll be at Little Valley. I'll be here at Herkimer.
And up walks Sarah. So we're done.
Oh, okay.
No. So just to kind of finish up, like at these conventions, like the lure dealers a lot of times are squabbling back and forth. Top Lot, you've got Reno's and other people that sell boards. Do you guys ever like have, you know, where you guys like, you know, take the belly wedges and like sword fight with them, or
no?
Would you be interested in doing something like that?
Well, no. But but we're not above me and Leon.
You and Leon against Reno?
Yeah. Leon was going out back to help F&T there, screw guns, so on and so forth. They needed this, they needed that, whatever. And I said, going over to get some top secrets there, are you? You're going to need some kindling wood for a campfire tonight?
Do you want to tell the best story with you and Leon and Denise about when they walked up here and you told them how long their board your boards last?
Yeah.
Can I tell the story?
Yeah, sure enough.
We're sitting at the campfire, and Denise and Leon and Kurt Obermeyer walked up, and we're all bullshitting, and they're talking boards back and forth, and Ronnie looked at Leon and said, "You know what? My boards last longer than my relationships." I'm about pissed my pants. Well, I just had a shitload of muskrats show up, so I guess I just had 800 and some muskrats show up, so I guess I got to go unload these. So, anyways, well, thanks for doing this, Ronnie, and if anybody wants to get boards, you know, from Ronnie, which I hope you do, you know, if you just look up Ronnie Smitty on Facebook, and if you can't reach him, just reach out to me, and I'll send you a link to his page. So, well, thanks, Ronnie.
Thank you, Jeff.